The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to today's podcast, sponsored by Hillsdale College. All things Hillsdale at hillsdale.edu. I encourage you to take advantage of the many free online courses there. And, of course, to listen to the Hillsdale Dialogues, all of them at hughforhillsdale.com, or just Google Apple, iTunes, and Hillsdale. Glory, America. Bonjour, hi, Canada. Hugh Hewitt, live inside the Beltway. Good morning to you. Good Friday to you. Thank you, Ed Morrissey, for sitting in for me yesterday. I appreciate Ed so much. I appreciate that Adam and Harley and Dwayne got everything going yesterday. If you missed yesterday's Look Through the Chaos podcast with Dwayne and John Campbell, you ought to go listen to that, because I was not here to talk Federal Reserve speak with you. And so I was listening to three podcasts yesterday flying home. Podcasts are made for exercise and flying. All right. So I read on airplanes and I listen to podcasts. I'm not a sleeper. And I went through three yesterday. I went through first the Look Through the Chaos, because I want to know what the Federal Reserve was doing, and Campbell explained it, and Dwayne played me, asking John, wait, I don't understand that. We don't do M2 money supply talk here. So that it's a very good podcast. Go follow Look Through the Chaos. Then I listened to maybe the most important podcast I've ever listened to. Ron Dermer, former ambassador of Israel to the United States, presently a member of the War Cabinet. There are six people in the War Cabinet, three vote, three observe. In Israel, and he sat down with Dan Senor on the Call Me Back pod and basically laid it all out for you. Israel is going to go into Rafah because they need to go into Rafah, and he explains why. I'm going to play a couple of cuts in a bit. But then, that's about an hour and 10 minutes. Then I listened to the commentary podcast with John Podhoretz and Christine Rosen and Abe Greenwald and Seth Mandel and Matt Continetti, explaining, they had also listened to Dan Senor podcast, what that podcast was all about. And let me explain something to you. I'm a Gentile from Ohio. I didn't know any Jewish people until I got to Harvard. And the only Jews I know are Boston, New York, Washington Jews. I mean, I know a few Jews in California. They're my real estate friends. All right. So I worked with them, and I met Bob and Toby in the St. Petersburg Synagogue, believe it or not, like 15 years ago. So I do have Jewish friends on the West Coast, but most of the Jews in my life are Boswash Jews. And they're different from Jews in the Midwest and Jews everywhere else. Most of them are very, very liberal and democratic. If you remember this show, Robert from New York, who I think must have gone to be with the Lord. He was sick for a while, but Robert from New York started out in the year 2000. Let me tell you something. He was Robert, let me tell you something. And it was a funny line. And he began calling the show occasionally. And I always talked to Robert. And I was always wrong until 9/11. And then after 9/11, really, literally, after 9/11, Robert became one of the most conservative. He became almost Yoni. So Robert went away a few years ago. And when that happens, like Eldon from Kentucky, who started the show and gave me my Morning Glory tag, he went away. I assume they have died. I didn't know them. So yesterday, I'm at a conference of the Real Estate Investment Trust Group, 1,000 people. I'm there with former Senator Heidi Heitkamp, who's very smart. And I always accept this speaking invite because this is 1,000 people who run the real estate world. And they're not the biggest ones necessarily, but they are everywhere. Like, there's a REIT in southeastern Virginia I didn't know about. And the professionals get together once a year. And when you can talk to 1,000-plus really smart people, I mean, these are all lawyers, accountants, investors, and explain to them that they got to vote for Donald Trump, and explain why what's going on in New York and the civil litigation is such an outrage. And that's a real estate seizure case, right? Trump's deadline is Monday, and I've got to assume the New York Appeals Court steps in, because this is such a miscarriage of justice that's going on in New York. I mean, it's really appalling. But I wanted to talk to them about that. But then afterwards, I talked to my new Robert from New York, Blake. Can't wait to get Blake on. I'm going about to go down the escalator, and Senator Heitkamp's with me, and it was right behind me. And Blake stops me, and Blake is my age. And Blake says, "Wait, you it. I watch you on Special Report." He hadn't been in the speech because he got up. He's at the REIT thing, but he got up too late. He's a lawyer, corporate lawyer, BC Law, went undergrad to Penn. He said, "Let me tell you something." And I'm like, "Oh, my God, it's Robert." And he's a Jewish guy, lives on the Upper East Side of New York. And he stops with David, who's wearing a kippah, and Senator Heidkamp. And then he says, "Hey, wait, you, Senator, come here." And Senator Heidkamp got an earful because Blake is a Democrat, or was a Democrat until October 7th. And, I mean, he'd been moving. He has a public affairs discussion group at his club in New York, and he invited me to that. I'm just going to have him on the show so he can talk to you about it, because it's the best explication of why he can't vote for Joe Biden ever that I've ever heard. It's because the party's just been captured by the left. It sounded like Chris Rufo materialized in the form of a 67-year-old Jewish guy from the Upper East Side of New York, who's, by the way, not a believer. You know, ethnically Jewish. He said, "You know, good for you, David. I love you. I love your kippah. I love everything, but I'm not, you know, that's not why I'm supporting Israel. I'm a Zionist." I said, "Well, we're all Zionists here." As far as I think Senator Heidkamp's a Zionist. And we had a great conversation. Then I, you know, get the car, jump in the car, go to the airport, listen to Ron Dermer. And I am blown away by what Dermer said. The first strategic podcast I've ever heard. He was clearly, he picked Dan Senor because Dan runs the podcast that most influential people in Washington, D.C. must listen to if they want to understand what is going on in Israel, along with Commentary Pod. So just a couple of samples from the Call Me Back podcast yesterday. Cut number 5.
Israel's doing military operations in the West Bank. We've done it since October 7th. Around 400. Mm-hmm. There have been 400 Palestinians who've been killed. And you want to know how careful Israel with civilian casualties? The last numbers I saw, I think it was 380 terrorists were killed, Palestinian terrorists in the West Bank, and 11 unintended casualties of civilians. 11. So you talk about ratios of 2-1 or 3-1. Right. This is like 38-1. Right. Okay? And but you don't have to go in with massive troops to do it. And so in Gaza, in a future Gaza, the only force that we see in the foreseeable future that could do demilitarization and to take action, your intelligence picks up that there's an underground tunnel where they're trying to remanufacture rockets and weapons and bombs, whatever. You have to go in and you have to take action. You have what you have in Shifa, you have somewhere else. So you have to do it. Those two things, prevent the weapons from coming in from Egypt and have those operations. But on the issue of de-radicalization, that to me is no less important, because one of the most horrific numbers of October 7th is not simply the 1,200 Israelis who were murdered in the most atrocious ways imaginable. It's not just the 240 who were taken hostage. It's the fact that 85% of Palestinians in the West Bank supported the October 7th attack. 85%.
All right, that was a put down the iPhone moment for me, because I had no idea. There's another one, which I'll play for you in the next segment. I'm not going to take all of Dan Senor's. You should listen to Dermer in the order that he explains it. It is the most comprehensive evaluation. And then right after it, listen to the Commentary Pod. I put both of these links at X, on my account on X, so you can do that. And the Commentary Pod are, of course, 5 Jewish Americans discussing what is become. There's a fringe movement among American Jews to condemn Israel. It's very fringy. And 90% of Israel supports the government, not Netanyahu. Like 1 out of 5 people in Israel supports Netanyahu. I listened to Habib Reddy Gur last night as well, and the numbers are terrible for Netanyahu, and they are 90% in favor of prosecuting the war and going into Rafah. So I've got a lot to talk to you about today, and you got to catch up on it. Couple of quick headlines. Congress isn't going to shut down. They're going to pass the $1.2 trillion today or tomorrow. The deadline for Trump's ridiculous bond is Monday, and I wrote my Fox News column yesterday about this. Due process for you, but not for Trump, because that what goes around comes around. You can't let Letitia James do this. You can't let Judge Engoron do this. Andy McCarthy and Rich Lowry in yesterday's McCarthy Report review all the Trump cases, but this one's outrageous. They talk about Trump. I think Trump's got a better case to sue George Stephanopoulos and ABC than Andy does. But defamation is very hard when you're a public figure. Must show knowing disregard for the facts and actual malice. But I think it's there. I do. There's a surge of migrants past the National Guard. I got to show you this tape. Roll this tape, Harley. This is what happens when the National Guard goes to the border and you don't have a wall. This is why you need a wall, because they just blew past the National Guardsmen. They're not gonna shoot them, right? The National Guardsmen are not gonna shoot them, but I was thinking, don't go Kent State. Don't have live ammo. Do not go Kent State. Been there, done that. The National Guardsmen should not be in this position and would not be in this position if we built the freaking wall. Meanwhile, U.S. pressure being brought to bear on Ukraine to stop hitting Russia oil refineries, and U.S. pressure, in fact, U.S. is going to bring, as Tony Blinken lands again in Israel to hector them, going to bring a resolution in the Security Council calling for a linked ceasefire and hostage release. I think this is nuts. I think that the turn against Israel by Team Biden is complete. They don't want to make it that clear. Meanwhile, the Mossad head is back in Doha for more talks about the hostages. Ron Dermer explains what is an acceptable resolution and what isn't. It's a two-part goal: destruction of Hamas, release of the hostages. And they're linked, but they ought not to be linked by the United States before the Security Council, because Israel means something very different than the United States does right now. More coming up. Don't go anywhere. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Good morning, America. Hugh Hewitt on this Friday, back inside the Beltway. Thanks to Ed Morrissey for sitting in for me yesterday. As I told you, Ambassador Ron Dermer, I've only met the ambassador once. I remember it distinctly. I was with John Podhoretz in the arcade in Cleveland during the 2016 GOP convention. And Ambassador Dermer came by, and of course, he knew J-Pod very well, and I hadn't met him, and we chatted for a while. He's fabulous, like Michael Oren. They usually send their best to the United States, who are usually originally U.S. citizens who then make aliyah. I'm probably mispronouncing it. My Hebrew is about as bad as my French, which doesn't exist. And so I knew that Dermer was good. I didn't know he was this good. And obviously, was sent to Ron Dermer. Go talk to Dan Senor, who all of a sudden is getting like tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of podcast downloads in Washington, D.C., and is talking directly into the bloodstream of decision makers as Team Biden tries to undercut Israel and impose a two-state solution. It just won't work right now, and it's just not going to work for a decade, two decades, until de-radicalization is done. And Dermer gives a tour de force. And so I want you to hear what he had to say. While I was away for my one day, Canada decides they're stopping all arms sales to Israel. I said, what? Canada? You know, Gold Beach, Canada? The Canadians that went to war against Hitler? What is going on? As John Podhoretz or someone said on the most polite country in the world. Now, my daughter-in-law is Canadian-American. Her parents are Canadian-Americans and Irish-Americans. And so I love Canada. Got nothing against Canada. But I cannot believe the lunatics in Canada did this. And Dermer spoke to this yesterday. I want you, Canada, to hear this, because you might not listen. You might not want to hear it. You might not want to know what the world thinks of you and what Israel thinks about you. But this is what I think about you, too. Cut number six.
They're worse than ISIS. Yeah. Good and evil. And that's what it is. And that gets lost. Now, it's not going to get lost in history. In history, it will be there front and center. And that's why everybody... You know, you said the Canadians today, they announced
no more arms sales.
Yeah, they're not going to do it. It's going to be a badge of shame for Canada. And it's going to last for a really long time, because in years to come and decades to come, people are going to look back on October 7th when those Hamas fighters came in and they beheaded people and they raped women and they burned babies alive and killed children in front of their parents and parents in front of the children. Where was Canada? Where's all the lines about Canada will support Israel? Really? Now you're going to deny weapons to Israel when we're fighting against sheer evil, because it's still sheer evil and we haven't finished the job. And
by the way, on Canada, which I lived in for a number of years, there's this book that the Canadians own the legacy of, which is called None Is Too Many, which is about the debates in the Canadian Parliament about how many Jews to allow into Canada that were trying to escape the Holocaust. And that was the line, none is too many. And so...
Yeah, well, listen, it's not going to wear well historically. It might for the moment and public opinion and their finger in the wind because of the difficult pictures. And I get it. You know, you see from Gaza and the difficulties. And believe me, the last thing we want is a single civilian to be killed in Gaza. But that should all be laid at the doorstep of Hamas, because if Hamas laid down their arms and left the place, we wouldn't have a single civilian to be killed. But we're not going to tolerate that organization that did what they did on October 7th, calling to do it again and again. We're not going to leave a quarter of them in place. I think here, actually, it was Gantz, Minister Gantz said in one of the meetings, he said, you know, you don't take out 80% of the fire, leave 20% and then hope it's going to turn out for the best, right? It's going to come back and it's going to rage and it's going to take over Gaza and we're going to have a problem. And just for the Canadians should know, I remember once I was upset with the Germans for leading the charge in the E3 on the whole nuclear deal. And I think a former German defense minister, I was speaking at some forum and he got up and he says, I'm so dismissive of what everything that Germany has done for the state of Israel and everything like that. I said, what are you talking about? In 1973, 25 years after the Holocaust, 1973, Germany would not allow American planes to land on their territory on their way to helping an Israel that was waging that war. Okay. He didn't have anything else to say from there. That's going to be a moment that Canada is going to have to deal with now. For 10, 20, 30, 40 years, that in Israel's darkest moment, they abandoned it.
Bingo! Bingo! Bingo!
I think it's shameful.
It is shameful. Canada, be ashamed. And I will be right back. Don't go anywhere. It's the Hugh Hewitt Show. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. I'm going to give you a little schooling here. Yesterday, Dan Senor, fabulous guy, frequent guest on the show. He runs the Call Me Back podcast. He put up a podcast with Ron Dermer. And Ambassador Dermer had been Israel's ambassador to the United States for a long period of time. He is now back in Israel, and he is a member of the war cabinet. And so what Israel does in the war with Hamas and what might happen in its responses to Hezbollah in the north and to Iran's nuclear program and to the IDF and to everything is decided in that room with six people. So he's in the room where it happens. So obviously the prime minister and the war cabinet directed Ron Dermer to find someone like Dan Senor, who is smart and who knows how to do a good podcast and to deliver a message right into the mainstream. You know, just inject it, put it right into the bloodstream of the American political consciousness. And it's a remarkable conversation. After you are done listening, now podcasts, as you know, I'm mostly a sports podcast guy. I have 16 podcasts that I follow. All right. And so I just run them down for you. Getting Hammered, I listen to Mary Catherine and Vic Mattis because they're funny and they're light and they're also political. Buckeye Talk, Orange and Brown Talk, Ultimate Cleveland Sports Show, and the Kings of the North and Civilized Barking, and of course Terry's Talking. These are sports pods for Cleveland and Ohio State sports. You're not going to be interested in that unless you follow the Browns, the Guards, the Cavs, the Ohio State University Buckeyes. But then I listen to the Journal, because they do an in-depth dive once in a while, and there's something like Reddit yesterday, something I don't know. The McCarthy Report, because Andy's a prosecutor's prosecutor. I am not, all right? So I've got to learn. I can dumb my way around the Takings Clause. I've been teaching the Constitution. But we don't do crim pro in con law. And Andy knows crim pro. And so I listen to Andy and Rich Lowry, whoever's sitting in for, sometimes Noah sits in for Rich. And Andy McCarthy is just the go-to guy on Trump trials 1 through 100. Then I listen to my deep dives on Israel. And that includes the daily briefing from the Times of Israel. It includes What Matters Now, which is a once-a-week deal with Aviv Redinger. It includes Honestly with Barry Weiss. It includes For Heaven's Sake by Daniel Hartman and Yossi Klein Halevi. It includes Call Me Back. And that way, what podcasting does, it's not like cable news where you don't know what's coming. You know what you're going to get. You're going to get a deep dive into the subject that is discussed. And yesterday's pod, here you go. Here are a few more cuts from it. Cut number one, Ron Dermer talking to Dan Senor.
The Holocaust is not 500 years ago. It's not. It's in living memory. You still have survivors of the Holocaust who are walking amongst us. What you saw on October 7th was a genocidal force that wants to wipe out all the Jews, and it's the first pogrom that we've had since the birth of the State of Israel. And in a fundamental way, the promise of this country, in my view, is not just that Jews return to their ancestral homeland, it's that we have the ability to defend ourselves. And in a fundamental way, that promise was broken on October 7th. And I think our job is to restore that promise. And that means utterly dismantling the terror organization of Hamas in Gaza. It's going to happen. And it will happen even if Israel is forced to fight alone. even if the entire world turns on Israel, including the United States, we're going to fight until the battle won. There's only one possible force that could stop Israel, and that's the Israeli people.
What I love about this is there are six people who are not in the IDF or Mossad or Shin Bet. That's the army in Israel, the intelligence, their CIA, and their FBI. There are only six people in the country who actually know what's going on. Ron Dermer is one of them. So he has asked by Dan Senor for a status update on the war. Cut number two.
Well, I think it's going very well in terms of prosecuting the war goals. You know, on October 7th, the government and the security cabinet met, and we laid out some goals that we wanted for the war, which is to dismantle Hamas's military capabilities, to end its political rule in Gaza, to ensure that Gaza no longer poses a threat to Israel, and also to return the hostages. So you can look at each one of those categories and see where we are. Let's start with actually the last one, the hostages, because there's hostage negotiations going on now. We hope that it would lead to an agreement. You can never be sure. There's also a lot of problems on the other side because you're dealing not only with the mediators, but you're dealing with Hamas that has an outside Hamas and an inside Gaza Hamas, and they don't communicate as quickly as you would like, and so you don't get answers back as quickly as you'd like. But let's hope that we can get...
meaning it's not just like this one, call that one. It's messages have to be transmitted, and then people have to travel with messages.
It's very complicated to do it. You don't
get multiple countries.
You don't get an answer right away. And I hope that we will be able to get into, a funnel that hopefully gets us to a deal. We had that first deal where we were able to get out 80 women and children as part of that first deal. Some of them were left behind. Hopefully in the second deal, they'll come back, those people who were left behind. And then we can continue on with this deal. And I'm cautiously optimistic that we can get there. But, you know, you don't know because it's very complicated. And they always see, I would say, that, you know, Hamas, even though we're in a war that's 5.5 months long, a lot of the war seems to me to have been waged in sort of 1 week or 2 week increments, like people looking 2 weeks down the road. And Hamas had some hopes at the beginning that Hezbollah would come all in, mm-hmm. and Iran would come all in. And then they may have hoped that in terms of hostage negotiations, that the government of Israel would succumb to internal pressures, or that the United States would stop the war. And then they may have hoped that Ramadan would be an opportunity for them to ignite the whole region. So what their state of mind is, I don't know. And the person who's most relevant here in the negotiations is somebody who's not around the negotiating table, right, but who's stuck in a hole somewhere or deep underground in a tunnel in Gaza, which is Sinwar, who ultimately will make the decision if we, from the Hamas side, if we get to a deal or if we don't, and we'll just have to see.
Now, I want to play one more cut. All right, cut number four is coming up. How is, again, Ron Dermer is one of six people not in the IDF. They're not going to talk to anyone, not in Mossad. He's not going to talk to you, not in Shin Bet. One of six people who knows what's going on. This is a strategic podcast. This Call Me Back podcast. One more cut. You've got to listen to the whole hour and 15 minutes to understand what is going on in Israel. But here is Ron Dermer, Minister of Strategy, Strategic Affairs in the Israeli War Cabinet, talking about how they measure success in the war in Gaza. Cut number four.
Hamas in Gaza is an army of terror. It's a terrorist army. It's different than Hamas in the West Bank. And that's what we said
on that particular point.
I'll explain to you how that army is structured.
Yeah, that's all. Because people, I think, in the West don't appreciate it. It's like a light infantry army. It's not a ragtag terrorist organization.
No.
It is a real military organization.
It's an army.
Right.
And that army is divided into battalions. Battalions are roughly around 1,000 people per battalion. The number of Hamas terrorists in Gaza at October 7th is probably around 30,000. And then Islamic Jihad, which plays Robin to Hamas's Batman there, they are, I don't want to besmirch Rob, you know, Batman and Robin, but 5,000 to 10,000 fighters. So let's, in the terrorists of Islamic Jihad. So you're talking about a terror army of about 40,000 that on October 7th, we set out to dismantle. Now, how are we doing in that job of dismantling them? Well, let's think about battalions, which is the organized structure. Because even when you defeat a country in battle, you know, when Nazis were destroyed and Hitler was, you got to Hitler's bunker and the Nazi army was taken out, not every single Nazi soldier was killed. There were many soldiers, mm-hmm. and there are many SS soldiers as well. But there are 24 battalions. 19 of the battalions have basically been defeated, maybe 18 and a half. It leaves around five and a half battalions left. Four of those battalions are in Rafah, which is the southernmost part of the Gaza Strip. Four of them. Under normal times, those battalions probably have around 1,000 people. The best estimate that I've seen is they've probably doubled in size. Why? Because as you defeat the terrorists in the north and they go to the south and you hit them more and more, the ranks in Rafah have swollen to the point where there's probably 8,000 terrorists in Rafah. So when the prime minister says we're going to go into Rafah, he means we're going to go in there and dismantle the remaining battalions of Hamas. Now, what happens after you dismantle? When you say you've defeated battalions, it doesn't mean that you've killed 100%. It means, I think, in military terms, and I'm not a military person, but this is what was told to me at the beginning of the war. You defeat a battalion, it means that 50% of that force is either killed or wounded.
So and the command structure is broken down.
The command structure is broken down, and so therefore they don't do an attack. The people who are left, where you're bringing 100 men or 200 men or even 50 or even 20. But it still means that you could have, in, let's say in the northern part of the Gaza Strip, there were 10 battalions, if memory serves. 10 battalions, so about 10,000 fighters. You've defeated all 10 battalions. So let's say 6,000 were either killed or wounded. You still have 4,000 people running around there, but they're not running around in the same structured way. So it means that three people can come out of a
do an ambush,
of a hole,
but they're not organized.
Do an ambush and do an RPG. And right. They're not organized in the command and control structure of the army.
That is the most succinct summary of what is going on in Gaza that I have heard. And my hat is off to the ambassador, now Minister Dermer, and to Dan Senor for interviewing him well. And if you have not heard this, this is a shot across. Because Tony Blinken is over there. Here's Tony Blinken yesterday, cut number 11.
The need for an immediate, sustained ceasefire with the release of hostages. President Biden's been very clear that a major ground operation in Rafah would be a mistake and something that
not for
support.
Tony Blinken to say. That is not for Joe Biden to say. It is for Ron Dermer and the War Cabinet to decide. And you've heard them say, we are going into Rafah. And what we have is a breach between America and Israel. And I hope it's not a big breach, but it's a breach. And what Dermer said that I want everyone to hear again, all right? Well, let's just play it again. Cut number one. Most important thing he said. Cut number one.
The Holocaust is not 500 years ago. It's not. It's in living memory. You still have survivors of the Holocaust who are walking amongst us. What you saw on October 7th was a genocidal force that wants to wipe out all the Jews. And it's the first pogrom that we've had since the birth of the state of Israel. And in a fundamental way, the promise of this country, in my view, is not just that Jews return to their ancestral homeland. It's that we have the ability to defend ourselves. And in a fundamental way, that promise was broken on October 7th. And I think our job is to restore that promise. And that means utterly dismantling the terror organization of Hamas in Gaza. It's going to happen. And it will happen even if Israel is forced to fight alone. Even if the entire world turns on Israel, including the United States, we're going to fight until the battle won. There's only one possible force that could stop Israel, and that's the Israeli people.
And the United States is not going to turn on them. Even if the Biden administration does and is doing it, the United States is still solidly behind Israel. I'll be right back, America. Stay tuned. Morning, glory, America. Bonjour, hi, Canada. I'm Hugh Hewitt inside the Beltway today. Ben Domenech returns. He is, of course, editor-at-large at The Spectator, Fox News contributor extraordinaire. Also, the podcast over at Fox News. And now that I am contributing twice a week at FoxNews.com, we are distantly related through the Fox News organization. Ben, I've got a lot to cover with you this morning, and I want to start by asking, have you heard the Ron Dermer interview with Dan Senor yet on the Call Me Back podcast?
No, I have not, though I did see you tweeting about it, which means I'm going to have to listen to it today.
It is quite remarkable. I'm going to play you one excerpt from it, which I already played for the audience, but give a listen. This is cut number one.
The Holocaust is not 500 years ago. It's not. It's in living memory. You still have survivors of the Holocaust who are walking amongst us. What you saw on October 7th was a genocidal force that wants to wipe out all the Jews. And it's the first pogrom that we've had since the birth of the State of Israel. And in a fundamental way, the promise of this country, in my view, is not just that Jews return to their ancestral homeland. It's that we have the ability to defend ourselves. And in a fundamental way, that promise was broken on October 7th. And I think our job is to restore that promise. And that means utterly dismantling the terror organization of Hamas in Gaza. It's going to happen. And it will happen even if Israel is forced to fight alone. Even if the entire world turns on Israel, including the United States, we're going to fight until the battle won. There's only one possible force that could stop Israel, and that's the Israeli people.
So, Ben Domenech, how do you respond to that?
Well, I think that, you know, the message to be sent there is obviously that, you know, the Democratic Party's interests in domestic politics, namely their response to the craziness that we've seen from the progressive left, particularly the young progressive left, which has had such a marked effect in the last couple of months and really, I think, explains so much about the way that this White House has behaved in nonsensical ways, in ways that are antagonistic to our allies. It really is not going to prevent Israel from doing what it needs to do. And I take that very seriously. You know, this is not a situation where the domestic politics of America, whatever drives Chuck Schumer to make the kind of comments that he made on the floor, whatever drives the type of attitude from the White House that we've seen, whatever drives the behavior of Tony Blinken in micromanaging what the Israelis do in order to defend themselves, that's not going to prevent Israel from doing what it needs to do. And frankly, they're completely right in saying that.
Now, Ben, I believe that American politics are realigning. And I had an experience in Miami yesterday with an Upper East Side man who's Jewish. And I'm going to talk with Blake on the air at some point. He stopped Senator Heitkamp, retired, and just laid into her about what's gone wrong with the Democrats, that the left is taking them over. It sounded like Chris Rufo showed up and materialized as a 68-year-old Jew from New York. And I was blown away. Do you think that's happening because of this? Because if you're a friend of Israel, you're watching this and you're pretty horrified by Blinken going over there and Joe Biden saying what he said and Chuck Schumer saying what he said. You're astonished what's going on.
I think that you're right that that realignment is happening. I think the question is how much it is going to be something that has a lasting effect on our politics. I do think that one of the things that we, you know, have to understand here is that there are a lot of people who are disabused of certain notions following the October 7th attacks. You know, they were comfortable sort of ignoring some of the crazier things that were being said because they didn't think that they were actually translating or were meaningfully affecting the opinions of leading politicians and people who could actually have an impact. And because they have learned that that's not the case, I think that they really are, you know, incredibly frustrated by the fact that for a lot of them, they've been supportive of the Democratic Party for a long time under the notion that this was something where they were supporting their friends and would be supported in return. And they have learned that that is simply not the case.
Now, Ben, I've got to also ask you, because you're one of the few people left who are actually, I try and be objective about the former president and how he's doing and how he's not doing. I am neither a Trump hater nor a Trump lover. I'm just a reporter of Trump. Sure. And I think he's ahead and I think he's going to win, but it's a long way. And I'm curious if you think this charade, this show trial, I wrote about this at FoxNews.com yesterday. I'm astonished that no one has stepped in to stop Letitia James and Judge Engoron. It is so manifestly wrong what is happening. How do you react to this, and what do you think it's doing for Trump's fortunes in the fall?
Well, I think that it is going to create some visuals that are not going to be helpful to Democrats, and already has to a certain extent. You know, you see the ladies on The View gleefully celebrating the idea of padlocking Trump Tower or something like that. I don't think the average independent voter is going to respond positively to that. And one of the things that I think Democrats, especially those, you know, who have been so diehard and knee-jerk opposed, you know, the resistance to Trump, understand is that there are a lot more Trump-Biden voters than you think. You know, people who voted against Hillary Clinton in 2016, then voted for Joe Biden in 2020 because they expected some return to normalcy, who now look back on things and say, wow, you know, I really didn't get what I thought I was going to get out of this presidency. And in fact, times were a lot better for me and for my family under Donald Trump. And I think that a lot of the people who are included in that portion are Hispanic voters, are, you know, minority voters within the working class, et cetera, across the country in critical swing states. And those are the same type of people who say, wait a minute, you I voted for this guy back in 2016, and now you're saying that he's someone who's a criminal who can't even, you know, keep his businesses running, or you know, this is the punishment that you want to lay against him. It seems very extreme. It seems anti-democratic, and it undercuts a major part of the Democratic message going into 20.
Whenever someone has to say that this is an unprecedented proceeding involving a former president, and we have to say that again and again and again and again, an unprecedented, that means the whole legal system has been bent to break Trump.
Yes.
And I think America realizes that the lawfare is bad. Now, let me ask you what I think, Ben. For the first time in my life, the vice presidential selections are going to matter, because Joe Biden's going to be 82 in November and Donald Trump's going to be 78 by the election, I think, or shortly thereafter. And the vice presidential selection, actuarial tables tell us this matters. I don't think it's going to be Nikki Haley, so let's just take that off the table. She exited the wrong way to make up Reagan Bush 1980 ticket possible. Who, if you want to win, do you put in that slot, Ben Domenech?
Well, I think that, you know, there's a strong case to be made for someone like Tim Scott, in the sense that he doesn't rock the boat, and he's also someone who I think could be has shown himself to be, you know, perfectly capable of making the case for the Trump agenda in a way that would, you know, potentially reach out beyond the way that certain, you know, sort of standard picks could go. One thing that I do think is important is that whoever he selects, it needs to be someone who is essentially liked by a broad range of different aspects of the country, and not just Republicans. And that's something that I think is kind of the risk factor here. There's going to be a lot of pressure for him to say, for, you know, among Republicans, I think, for them to say, well, let's just pick someone who, you know, is going to be loyal to you. It needs to be someone who can go into places that are not necessarily the places that Donald Trump can go, in order to make the case for their agenda. And that's something that, you know, I think, you know, there are a number of different possibilities on that front, but one of the reasons that I think Scott has that kind of appeal is that he's shown, you know, if you think back again, you know, the handful of moments that he had during his brief run that were really interesting was when he was frustrating the left by, you know, forcing them to basically say the soft part loud, and when they were, you know, depicting him as an Uncle Tom and that kind of thing. And that's something that I think, you know, especially if the reporting is correct, that the former president is very much of a mind on increasing his support among black men, that's something that I think could factor into this.
All right. Now, my short list doesn't include Senator Scott. I think he's too nice, but I could be wrong about that. I think you need a Nixon in 52, generational change, and an attack dog. And I want either Tom Cotton or Joni Ernst or Mike Pompeo. I want someone who can, you know, if you walk point on a platoon in Baghdad during the surge, you're not going to be afraid of any Democrats. And Pompeo's is a brawler, and Joni Ernst is a soldier. I think a veteran helps here, Ben.
Well, I will say that the three people that you just named are all great, but the intelligence size gap between Kamala Harris and Mike Pompeo
yeah.
is so great, it might as well be the Grand Canyon. So I think that, you know, this is, you know, if you pick someone like that for that job, the only query that I would have for you on that is, to a certain extent, does that change the role of the vice presidency? If you put someone who is that strong of a personality in that role.
And who's going to be running for president in 4 years. That's exactly. The bridge to the, and he's 60 years old. So that's actually, they're all bridges to the next time. And I like that. You just made me laugh. Thank you, Ben. Because that makes my weekend. The idea of a Pompeo-Harris debate.
Oh, my God. Are you
can we use the word bloodbath anymore, or is that off the table?
Absolutely.
That's Ben Domenech. Follow him on X at B Domenech. Listen to his podcast over at Fox News Podcast and at The Spectator, where he's the editor-at-large. I'll be right back, America. Thank you, Ben. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Sarah Bedford with the Washington Examiner joins me, as she does most Fridays. Good morning, Sarah. Good Friday to you. How are you?
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
$1.2 trillion appropes minibus barreling through the Congress. Is it going to make it in time before the lights are turned off for a day or so?
It's going to be a really tight squeeze. There are conservative Republicans and even some not so closely associated with the Freedom Caucus who are unhappy with it. There are progressive Democrats who are unhappy with it. And assuming that it gets through the House with a 2/3 majority, which is a big if, Then when it goes to the Senate, all 100 senators have to be on board. Chuck Schumer can't lose anybody in the Senate. So it is going to be a bit of a tight squeeze, but you're still hearing optimism from leadership in both chambers, which means perhaps this will get over the finish line, but it is going to be close.
Now, I want to focus in on Homeland Security. Some video came out yesterday, which we're going to show our watchers on the Salem News Channel, of migrants just blowing past the National Guard down on the border. And I think this is actually the killer for Joe Biden's campaign because they are inept. They cannot do anything about the border. Does the new approach, it's got Homeland Security in it, does it do anything for the border?
Conservative Republicans say not enough. And, you know, one thing that is missing from this bill is new funding for the border wall, which is something that you've talked a lot about. We've discussed frequently. It's something that's necessary to help secure the border. That's not in there. Now, there are a few thousand new detention beds that are going to be funded under this bill, new hiring incentives for Border Patrol agents, funding for overtime pay for Border Patrol agents, so hopefully to grow the size of the Border Patrol workforce. But conservative Republicans say that's not enough to secure the border when it's very clear that the Biden administration is actively resisting any deportations or detentions of migrants. And I do think that that is a compelling argument against this being enough in the appropriations bill.
And does this bill ban TikTok? Chuck Schumer could have attached TikTok here. Did he do so?
They did not. It does not ban TikTok. That's something that has finally momentum on Capitol Hill after repeatedly being stalled. But I do think that's something that the Senate is under pressure to take up. And the arguments against the TikTok divestment bill are getting weaker and weaker. So perhaps we will see this dealt with after the shutdown or the avoided shutdown. We'll have to see.
I do not know why Chuck Schumer is hard on Israel and soft on TikTok, but that's what he is. Let me ask you about the judicial nominees. Mitch McConnell just sliced and diced one of the nominees yesterday while saying, look, we're going to approve this Muslim American judge over here, and we're not going to approve this Muslim American judge over here. And it's got nothing to do with religion. It's got to do with their records. Have you been following that closely? Because it's very rare for the Democrats to turn on a Biden judicial nominee.
I have. And you already have two Democrats, Joe Manchin and Catherine Cortez Masto, who have said they are not going to vote for this nominee that you're talking about, Adil Mangy, who is accused of having ties to an academic center that hosted terrorist sympathizers on the anniversary of 9/11. He's has ties to a group that has celebrated police killers. So he has some pretty radical stuff in his background, accused of having some of those anti-Semitic ties. And I think Mitch McConnell's point was a salient one, which is that the Islamophobia accusation against Republicans and now Democrats who oppose this nominee is pretty lazy, because here is this other Muslim American judge that is heading to confirmation. It's not about this nominee's religious or ethnic background. It's because this nominee has some radical leftist ties.
Well, that is exactly correct. And so I'm glad that you're covering it. I want to play one more bit of audio. I hope we have enough time. It's Mike Gallagher yesterday talking about Gaza.
Maybe attempt to simplify it. I mean, we are fortunate to live in a democracy. And Dr. Wallander, would you say that the United States military in general holds itself to the highest ethical standards, moral and ethical standards?
Yes, Congressman.
Would you say that our military takes great effort to avoid civilian casualties wherever possible?
Yes, Congressman.
Do you believe the United States intentionally targets civilians?
I believe the U.S. military does not intentionally target civilians.
And then in Israel, we have a vibrant democracy as well. This is a great thing. Do you believe that the Israeli Defense Forces hold themselves to a high moral and ethical standard, just as the United States does?
I do believe that the Israeli Defense
Thank Forces you, are. Mike Gallagher. Did you watch that hearing at all, or the hearing earlier in the week, Sarah?
I didn't catch that particular moment, but I know obviously this has been a tricky week for the Biden administration, because they're kind of talking out of both sides of their mouth when it comes to what the IDF is doing right now.
Yeah, they're getting killed. They're getting killed by Democrats on the left who don't want to do anything for Israel, and friends of Israel who are longtime Democrats who are saying, what in the world is Blinken doing? And do you hear this in the hallways, that they're getting torn apart over this? They should just stand with Israel, but they're not.
Well, there's frustration that the Democrats aren't singing from the same song sheet, and the White House is not providing them any guidance, because one minute they're calling for the idea of ceasefire, permanent ceasefire, whatever, and the next moment they're staunch Israeli allies. There's no guidance for Democrats.
Sarah C. Bedford, as always, great to talk with you. Thank you for joining me on Friday for our wrap-up. Time for me to remind everyone, Alliance Defending Freedom is a sponsor of our show, and I love Alliance Defending Freedom because they do defend the Constitution. It's under assault everywhere. The latest and the most pressing series of cases in the public mind, and you won't hear Democrats talk about this, is boys playing girls' sports. And whenever anyone objects and they get thrown out or fired or barred, when trans women wish to use the spaces reserved for women for changing, et cetera, or to play sports with women or girls, and they get fired for speaking their mind or they get barred from a sport, ADF will usually step up and represent them. Alliance Defending Freedom has long defended life. It has long defended the Free Exercise Clause. It has long defended the correct understanding of the Establishment Clause. It has long won everything. And it wins and it wins and it wins. And the very best lawyers in America forsake money in order to serve their faith and your freedom, and you ought to support them. At the Alliance Defending Freedom, the banner is at the top of HughHewitt.com. Please go there and be square and give them $100 or $50 or $500. Generalissimos, Kenny Duane, did you have to fit inside of any machine for MyPhDWeightLoss.com? Did you have to go? You had your cancer screen.
I had a cancer screen. This was not a... I'm 7 years along from cancer that I don't need to have an actual PET CT scan every single year. I can go every other year now.
But you can fit in more easily now. You should just go in and show
it. I can fit in the tube easier, yes.
Well, didn't they want to just test that out?
No. And you know, you lay on the tube and then the belt kind of goes into the machine, right?
I hate that tube. I've tapped out of that tube more often. Okay. I cannot do it. I have to have open MRI.
Well, I'm not that claustrophobic, but you know, I don't need a diesel engine to move the tray to put me into the tube anymore. Like
I was
going to
say, it took two or three technicians to push the old cart, right?
Yes, yes.
864-644-1900. That's
864-644-1900.
If you want to lose weight, the old-fashioned way, Duane lost 50 pounds, has kept it off, stayed in his range by using MyPhDWeightLoss.com, and I hope you're maintaining.
I am maintaining. I talked to Rachel, my nutritionist, this week, and everything's going like it's supposed to.
All right. I just wish I was there to supervise, but I'm not sure. Welcome back, America. Sonny Bunch, the official movie critic of the Hugh Hewitt Show, joins me. He is the host of Across the Movie Aisle with Sonny Bunch, and the bulwark goes to the movie to podcast for the cinema inclined. Good morning, Sonny. How are you?
I'm good, Hugh. How are you?
Good. I'm going to go see Dune tomorrow on an IMAX. So I haven't seen it yet, Dune 2. And I haven't seen Ghostbusters
yet. Okay.
So do not tell me anything I don't know, but I've read the book, so I kind of know what's going to happen, but I don't know anything. What am I going to be happy tomorrow?
Which IMAX are you going to?
In Alexandria, Virginia. Going to go across the river.
Okay, you're just the AMC. Yeah. Hoffman. Is that the one? Right. That's a good one. I like Dune Part Two quite a bit. So Dune Part Two picks up almost immediately where Dune Part One left off. I mean, as you remember, he at the end of Dune Part One has just defeated Jemis in one-on-one combat. He is headed to the to live with the Fremen in the desert, and it picks up right there. And this is a slight difference from the book in that in the book there's a 2-year gap. They basically skip ahead 2 years to where he has been living in Siege Tabor for 2 years. Shani is his wife. He has a child. All that is skipped in this. He basically We see what happens during that 2 years. His training, his assuming the leadership of the Fremen, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a slight difference there. But I like this movie a lot. And it's the first time, Hugh, that I've watched a movie with Timothée Chalamet and come away from it thinking, I get why they keep putting him in movies. Like, I get why he is or could potentially be a movie star.
There's a moment. I've never understood it.
He doesn't work for me. You know, he's just always come across as too much of a child. But at the end of this movie, there's this moment where he gives the big speech, rallying the Fremen to his side to fall behind him and take on the hated Harkonnens in house warfare. And it works, and it's great. I mean, I think the way I described it in my review.
He's getting older, right, Sonny? It's like a boy band gets older, and most of them go away, and one or two of them end up superstars, like Justin Timberlake. And so you're telling me he's basically become a man.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's certainly part of it. But I mean, he's still very young. You know, he still has that youthful feel to him. But there again, in this movie, he is not whiny, I guess, is one way to look at it. He often comes across as whiny in his films, very, you know, kind of callous.
Well, you can't be whiny and lead the Fremen. To me a little bit about Ghostbusters, because we're a little short on time today, but I do want to know whether or not, please tell me it's not awful, because Bill Murray's in it, and it can't be awful, right?
Well, Hugh, did you like Ghostbusters Afterlife? So remember, a couple years ago, Ghostbusters Afterlife comes out.
No,
and it's
no.
Okay, so Ghostbusters Afterlife was basically a sequel, a direct sequel, almost to the first Ghostbusters movie. I mean,
correct.
It didn't even really do much with Ghostbusters 2. And it completely ignored the 2016
disaster.
Remake. And that movie was steeped in nostalgia. I mean, just every the villain was a direct callback to the first movie. There were little touches throughout, like, for instance, you know, the reason the ghosts are in this small town that the family were following. Is because they're at a selenium mine, which was owned by Ivo Shandor, so he could build his building in New York City. And like, if the words Ivo Shandor and selenium mean anything to you in a Ghostbusters context, that's the sort of movie for you. It's a real nostalgia fest, and I mostly liked it. Honestly, I didn't love it, and the references did start to grate on me. And I will say Ghostbusters Frozen Empire is like that, but turned up two or three notches.
Oh, good.
Just everything is a reference to something. Every shot is a reference to something from the first two movies, you know, be it in the background or in the foreground. Lots of characters show up just so audiences can be like, I remember that guy from the first movie.
Excellent.
It moves the action from Nebraska or wherever it was in Afterlife back to New York City for this one. They have moved into the fire station where the Ghostbusters headquarters was in the first two films, and they are they're there to bust some ghosts and
we got Murray and Aykroyd back, right?
Bill Murray, Dan Aykroyd's back. Winston Zeddemore, Ernie Hudson, he's back.
Oh,
one problem with this movie is that there's like 17 Ghostbusters. There's just an enormous number of people.
Army of Ghostbusters.
It's the new family. It's the old guys, and then the old guys have recruited their own team of, you know, people working in labs and stuff. I mean, there's just so many people. A friend of mine described this movie as a movie of B plots, and that's a really good shorthand. I wish I'd stolen it from my review.
A movie of what?
A movie of B plots. So it's a movie of it's a movie of subplots is the problem here. The big overarching story, which involves an ancient pre-Sumerian god coming back and killing everybody with his frozen terror breath or some such. It's not very interesting. We don't spend much time with it, and instead we spend like 2 minutes with every character as they do like little side quests. And I,
oh, that's good. Now I got one sub question, like a subplot.
Sure.
In the movie The Greatest Night in Pop, the second most uncomfortable person is Dan Aykroyd. The first most uncomfortable person is Bob Dylan by a long shot, but then Dan Aykroyd has a tie on and he's in the back row. Did you see that yet?
Yeah. No, I
did. You notice that Dan Aykroyd looks like, I'm a comedian, what am I doing?
It's very funny. Well, it's funny because my wife asked me the same question. She was like, why is Dan Aykroyd there? Why is he there? And I was like, well, I guess it's because of the Blues Brothers.
The Blues Brothers, sure.
Which was out right around this time, was a huge hit. People love the Blues Brothers.
Dan Aykroyd is clearly not a musician, and John Belushi might have been, but he's standing around among 30 pop stars, and it's sort of like, send me into a sports situation with athletes. I don't know how to talk to him because it's not my world. And he just stands there in his tie. Someone told him to come to this studio. He shows up in a tie.
And it is funny too, because you know, like in that movie, they talk about how they had to, you know, put people together for different harmonies, and you know how they had to combine voices to make it. And that was never discussed with Dan Aykroyd. Nobody was ever like, "We got to get a harmony with Dan Aykroyd." And,
Stevie Wonder didn't call Dan Aykroyd over to help him out.
Yeah.
No. Well, Sonny Bunch, follow him on X at Sonny Bunch. Read his reviews in the Washington Post and elsewhere, and get his two podcasts, Across the Movie Aisle and The Bulwark Goes to the Movie, if you are a movie person. And I will bring back my report on Dune. Don't think I'm going to see Ghostbusters for a couple of weeks, but we will see. Thank you, Sonny.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.